October 1802. We are in the Vienna suburb of Heiligenstadt, in the home where Beethoven was staying for a half a year at the advice of his doctor. He is young, age 28. He's writing a personal testament to his brothers Karl and Johann. This testament was discovered only many years later, after he had died. Beethoven is struggling to come to terms with a tragedy that has struck. His condition is otosclerosis, the growth of a spongy bone inside the ear. Nowadays, it's possible to surgically treat this condition or to install a hearing aid, but nothing could be done for this young man. He writes, "My poor hearing haunts me everywhere like a ghost. For almost 2 years, I have ceased to attend any social functions because I find it impossible to say to people, 'I am deaf.' If I had any other profession, it would be easier. But in my profession, it is a terrible handicap. As for my enemies, of whom I have a fair number, what would they say? I am forced to seem a misanthrope, and yet I am far from one. I am deaf. What a humiliation when someone standing next to me heard a flute in the distance and I heard nothing. Such incidents have brought me to the verge of despair. A little more of that and I would have put an end to my life." We've entered the season of Advent in the Christian tradition and Hanukkah in the Jewish tradition. Both faiths proclaim the message of deliverance, deliverance from tragedy and suffering. You may recall the book by Rabbi Harold Kushner asking, "Why do bad things happen to good people?" And of course, the title of Kushner's book is not "Why," but "When?" Because the question "Why?" amidst the ashes of evil and suffering usually ends up nowhere. Once upon a time, there is a man in the Rhineland whose name was Ludwig. This man was neither blameless nor upright. For a while, he feared God, as nominal Roman Catholics did at the time, or were supposed to do. He even turned away from evil once in a while, and then a tragedy struck his life. Ludwig's father was a musician. Noting the dazzling career of the young Mozart, he tried to exploit young Ludwig to also become a young prodigy. The father's methods for doing this were harsh and abusive. Sometimes the boy would be dragged from bed late at night on his father's return from the local tavern and forced to practice the piano under threat of severe punishment. Outside music, the father cared nothing at all for Ludwig's education. The youngster attended a grade school for only a short time. His fellow students remembered him as dirty and uncared for. And he refused to blossom into an infant prodigy of the Mozart order. Exactly when Beethoven began to grow deaf, we can't be exactly sure. In his prodigious letters, there's no explicit mention of it until he reached his mid to late 20s. But throughout adolescence and young adulthood, he was morose, a social recluse. Perhaps social interaction, which after all is mostly a verbal, conceptual, and content-oriented experience, perhaps that was simply too embarrassing for him to endure. The turning point in Beethoven's life was this so-called Heiligenstadt Testament, part of which we read a moment ago. It's a letter to his two brothers, Karl and Johann, not discovered till long after his death. He describes the torment of his suffering, and at the same time, his determination to transcend that suffering. Not through cynical, stubborn defiance. He had no need for such defiance because there was no longer anything to fear. But he had become aware within himself of a creative energy that nothing could destroy. Beethoven was absolutely exultant in this point in his life, in his resolute determination to transcend the despair and not to wallow in it. At the time, he was sketching the theme of the great C major fugue of the Razumovsky Quartet. He stopped working, and in the margins of the manuscript of that piece of music, he declared that from now on, nothing could hinder his composing. He wrote these words in the margin: "In the same way that you are now able to throw yourself into the whirlpool of society, so you are able to write your works in spite of all social hindrances. Let your deafness no longer be a secret, even for art." End of quote. So he is no longer afraid of his art or his identity as an artist. He no longer fears that, as he had written, "The most beautiful years of my life must pass without accomplishing the promise of my talent and powers." Okay, what happened to Beethoven in this process? He was certainly not transformed into some kind of charismatic matinee idol. He was still, let's say, a slob. His manners remained atrocious. He ignored conventions. He accepted just none of the schemes of thought or conduct that were current at the time. And this was Vienna. This wasn't Kansas. This was Vienna. He was impervious to criticism. He knew who he was and where he needed to go. He moved forward by sheer determination. The incredible scherzo of the Ninth Symphony is a brilliant example of this driving force. Touch, 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 touch. It's always interesting to see the tempo at which conductors take this scherzo. The first piece of music that Beethoven composed after his Heiligenstadt Testament had a profound spiritual content. That's the Eroica Symphony, number 3. But it's more than a piece of symphonic music. It's a transcription of the composer's personal spiritual struggle. He was telling his own story when he made the courage and heroism of the first movement of the Eroica, succeeded by the black night of the second movement, the funeral march. Some of you may remember the day JFK was shot. The Boston Symphony was all set to begin the Friday afternoon concert at the moment. Maestro Eric Leinsdorf got the word backstage what happened. He simply walked out on stage, raised his baton, told the musicians, second movement of the Eroica. They knew it by heart. They didn't need the scores. And then the final movement of his third symphony, the Prometheus theme. Having survived tragedy and despair, the artist turns to creation. Never before in music has there been such a completely coherent spiritual journey communicated in a score. The challenge for Beethoven at this point in his life had nothing to do with arguments and explanations of why and all of that stuff about good and evil. This was not about explanations. His most important states of consciousness were not reducible to verbal concepts. In the choral anthem of the Mass in C major, this is far more than his setting of a Latin text. It is an affirmation of the truths of his life. The same with his only opera, Fidelio. The most powerful moment is the prisoner's chorus, this cry. But it's not a wail. It is a from the heart in 16-part harmony of the necessities of being free from imprisonment and suffering. The power of hope is transcending suffering. Okay, let's fast forward to the modern era. 21st century. Tragedy in the 21st century. Many of you remember the 2004 earthquake tsunami in the Indian Ocean, at which hundreds of thousands lost their lives and were displaced. Hundreds of thousands. In the days following this earthquake and tsunami, a Western journalist traveled along the coast of Thailand, one of the countries that was hardest hit by the tsunami. And in his travels, this is amazing, he never heard the Thai people ask or even whisper, why? The Thai people, who are Buddhists, they have no personal god to blame or to bow down to or to lose faith in. Thai Buddhists have made practical compassion the pillar of their society. Those of you who've been to Thailand will know this. And the phrase they use is Nam Jai, a term often used when people speak of the courage of those who may have died trying to save the lives of others, or those who left their homes and families to join in the search for others and for their missing children and missing parents and grandparents and so on. Nam Jai is not a sort of heroic term. It's not, ain't I great for being compassionate? It means consideration from the heart. It's an almost intuitive response to trauma and suffering. This is what Guam is about, of course. And the roots of that term, Nam Jai, are deep in Buddhism. Deep within Buddhism, both the Theravada form of Buddhism in South Asia and the Mahayana form in North Asia. This is practical compassion. It's not defeatism. It arises in the dignified decision to generosity and gratitude and compassion, and not to wallow in anger or resentment or blame or trying to figure out what got us into this mess. So it is in the aftermath of tragedy. We got a choice, friends. We have a choice either to consecrate or to desecrate, to bless or to curse, to honor the world in all its glory and in all of its brokenness. We got that choice. Some of you may remember, 50 or 60 years ago, Archibald MacLeish's play, J.B., which of course is based on the book of Job in the Hebrew Bible, J.B. In MacLeish's play, J.B. and his wife Sarah, they are left alone among the ashes after calamity. They are left alone in the ashes, just the two of them. And Sarah speaks. These are Sarah's words. You wanted justice, didn't you? There isn't any. There's just the world. If you cry for justice, the stars will stare until your eyes sting. Weep and enormous winds will thrash the water. Cry in your sleep for your lost children. Snow will fall, snow will fall. The candles in churches are out. The lights have gone out in the sky. You wanted justice. And there is none, but there is love. There is only love. The candles in churches are out. The lights have gone out in the sky. But blow on the coals of the heart. Those glowing coals, give them some oxygen, give them some breath, give them some new life. Blow on the coals of the heart, and we'll see by and by.